Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, Serbia's integration into Europe. We speak to President Boris Tadic following his audience with Pope Benedict XVI. Serbian Orthodox Patriarch Pavle's legacy after his passing, and She's a Little Lady with a Giant-Sized Dream. The official portrait painter of the Pope's wants to paint the next Sistine Chapel. We find out more about her. Serbia's integration into the European Union and positive dialogue between the Catholic Church and the Serbian Orthodox Church were at the heart of talks between Pope Benedict XVI and the President of Serbia, Boris Tadic. The Serbian President was here in the Vatican at the weekend for an audience with the Pope. He spoke to Emer McCarthy about Serbia's role in Europe.
I'm highly respecting the position of the Holy Father and the Holy See at home. In terms of European integrations for whole Western Balkans, not only for Serbia. 2014 is an agenda adopted by Prime Minister of Greece, Mr. Papandreou, and Prime Minister of Italy, Mr. Berlusconi. That is going to be 1 year after celebration of the Edict of Milano. And from that reason, I think that this period, this momentum is becoming most important right now and a realistic option for further integrations of the whole Western Balkans in the European Union. Without clear support of Pope Benedict XVI, this is not possible. The Holy Father is very helpful, not only in ecumenical dialogue between Orthodox and Catholic Church, but also in terms of integration whole Western Balkans in European Union. This is one very important strategical goal, not only for my people and Serbian people, but also for whole Europe from my point of view. We are only one part of Europe that is not integrating until today. And from that reason, I see that that is becoming one of the most sensitive issues in political arena in Europe today. And from that reason, I understand that the approach of Holy Father is extremely important and extremely significant for Serbia and Europe in that respect.
What would you say the Balkan nations in general, but Serbia in particular, can bring to the European Union?
In terms of so many fields, we can be very helpful. First of all, Serbian democracy is providing stability, even though we are facing with the crucial challenges, for example, Kosovo, for example, Bosnia-Herzegovina. I mean, Kosovo is our southern province. We are not recognizing ethnically motivated attempt of secession that can open Pandora's box in so many areas all around the world. But the way how we are approaching to that challenge is stabilizing not only our country, but whole region. Second, the Bosnia issue. Serbia is one of the guarantors of Dayton's agreement. And from that reason, we are taking this principled position, and we are going to continue our efforts to find political solution in Bosnia-Herzegovina for so many challenges. Third, the Balkans is the shortest way from Western Europe towards Eastern Europe. And even from that reason, Balkans has to be integrated in European Union.
A bridge with Russia, perhaps?
Of course. And we are bridge. And when I'm saying, and when I'm using the old definition of my country, that Serbia is the east on the west and the west on the east, I'm clearly explaining why Serbia and the whole Western Balkans are becoming more important for European future than before.
What do you think the resolution to the Kosovo situation is?
I mean, after the decision of International Court of Justice that is coming in the next few months, we'll be in a better conditions to restart negotiations with the Kosovo Albanians and to find some sustainable and compromise solution on Kosovo. Serbia is every state is a defending legitimate national interests on Kosovo. by using only diplomatic and legal instruments. But after the decision of International Court of Justice, we have to negotiate about possible solution. And the last minute of formal negotiations, Serbia's authorities offered some solutions. And we are not insisting on some particular solutions right now, but we are going to be ready to open talks, and starting from the principal position that integrity of some country is internationally recognized, but at the same time we are trying to find solution that is going to be acceptable also for Kosovo Albanians. This is not policy against Kosovo Albanians. This is policy that is going to bring all people together and to find solution that is going to function in the period ahead of us and that is going to be sustainable for everybody. From my point of view, this is not functioning, solution in which one side is losing everything, that is Serbia and Kosovo Albanians, the other side is getting everything. And this is why I'm insisting on that approach. And we are going to continue our efforts. Serbia is not going to recognize Kosovo independence. This government, this president, but I'm sure that the new government, the next president, whoever is going to be on the power in Serbia is not going to recognize Kosovo independence. We have to find, but at the same time, we have to find a compromise solution. We do not want to repeat the failures from the past. We are ready for compromise.
Serbian President Boris Tadic. Well, the head of the Serbian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Pavle, died Sunday at the age of 95 after a prolonged illness. Pavle had led the church since 1990, guiding it through the post-communist revival and calling for peace and reconciliation during the Balkan conflicts. Lydia O'Kane spoke to Felix Corley, editor of the Religious Freedom News Service, Forum 18, about the patriarch's life and legacy.
He very much spoke his mind. He spoke in a way that ordinary people could understand and relate to. He wasn't so much interested in ecclesiastical politics and so on. So I think he kept a steady course. He tried to rebuild the church. And don't let's forget the communist Yugoslavia imposed very tight restrictions on the church, although they were not as tight as in other Eastern European countries, especially places like Czechoslovakia, then Czechoslovakia, and in the Soviet Union. But nevertheless, there were strong restrictions. And in the 1990s, he worked hard to reopen institutions, get seminaries going again, reopen parishes, especially in Kosovo, where he was the long-term bishop there.
What kind of a legacy does he leave behind?
I think he leaves an image in people's mind of how they want their clergy to be, how they want their church to be, as holy, devout, spiritual, someone that people could look up to in a spiritual sense, not look up to physically because he was very diminutive in size, look up to spiritually, and the kind of better side of the church.
Forum 18 editor Felix Corley. Artists today can aspire to the kind of greatness that opened the doors of the Vatican to such masters as Michelangelo, Raphael, and Bernini. But there is one young woman who dares to dream that one day her name will be added to the list of unforgettable artists whose works adorn such places as the Papal Apartments, the Pauline Chapel, and the Vatican Museums. Masterpieces to be cherished and studied for centuries to come.
In realtà ho cominciato a disegnare prestissimo, praticamente prima di imparare a camminare.
I began painting when I was just a little girl, practically before I even learned to walk. My mother understood this was my calling, and so when I was 5 years old, she enrolled me in a special school of design. I was 1 year younger than the rest of the children. When I was 11, I succeeded in getting into one of the best art schools in Moscow. There I was able to really expand on my passion and improve my drawing and painting skills. It helped me get into Moscow's Academy of Fine Arts, an extremely difficult school to get into.
All'Accademia delle Arti, perché la scuola era abbastanza forte.
Natalia Tsarkova grew up in Moscow in the Soviet era and witnessed the dawning of perestroika and the fall of the Berlin Wall.
È fondamentale avere avanti dell'età di bambina avanti questo esempio dell'artista.
From the time I was a child, it was fundamental to me to look to the great masters as examples. Artists such as Michelangelo, Caravaggio and Velázquez, but also the Russian school of the 1800s called Передвижника. This period, too, was very important for me.
Under a communism that obliterated the faith, churches were destroyed and Bibles were banned. It might be something of a miracle that Bibles were a permitted textbook at the Moscow Academy of Fine Arts where Natalia studied. But then again, the gospel stories and iconography of the Bible are the very things that have inspired some of the world's greatest artists for more than 2,000 years.
Ho sempre provato una forte attrazione per l'arte sacra.
I have always felt a strong attraction to sacred art, ever since I was a child when I went to art school. Reading the Bible, for example, was even part of our study program. I believe that it was this charismatic presence of the Lord which pointed me in this direction. As His Holiness Pope John Paul II said in his letter to artists, the Church needs art to render visible the invisible, the world of the Spirit, of God. And I too heard this call.
Anche io ho sentito questo richiamo.
A petite blonde with rosy cheeks and an angelic smile, Natalia could easily be mistaken for one of the ephemeral cherubs in her compositions. But don't be fooled by her appearance. This little lady is well on her way to realizing one big dream, not just of being the first woman to paint the official portraits of the popes, but ultimately to be the first woman to paint something as grand as the Sistine Chapel.
Natalia Tsarkova is not only artistically gifted, but also she has a great vision of these stories. She thinks a great deal upon the holy stories before she paints them. She gets to understand her subject before she does a portrait. And so if I were to be decorating a large-scale chapel or putting in a new refectory painting, Natalia Tsarkova would be the first person I thought of.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University and is a regular guest on Vatican Radio.
Natalia's already had some experience with doing larger format paintings in which she has to find a new 21st century way of treating an iconographical subject, which is 700, 800, 1,000 years old. And I think what's even more interesting in her body of work is that she has also had the opportunity to create an iconography and something that she has done, again, splendidly well.
Natalia was the first woman to study at Moscow's prestigious Academy of Fine Arts and the first to graduate. I asked her what women can contribute to the arts that sets them apart from their male colleagues.
In realtà io sono stata per un periodo l'unica donna a frequentare l'accademia.
Well, for a period I was the only woman student at the academy because it was extremely rare that a woman be admitted. In that period, for example, my maestro would say that a woman's place was in the home, with family.
Young boys at the academy used to come up to Natalia and tease her. "Why are you here?" they'd ask. "You won't have time to paint when you're married and having kids."
Penso che, almeno per la mia esperienza, le donne possono contribuire all'arte.
I think that, at least in my experience, women can contribute to art through communicating a different sensitivity, perhaps even a different energy. And this is because women have had to work hard to emerge in a world dominated by men, and it's not easy for women.
E spesso resa difficile per le donne.
It wasn't easy for Natalia to leave her family and her home to come to Italy in 1994. But it didn't take her long to earn a name for herself as a portrait painter for the Roman nobility. And then came her biggest commission ever.
La voce si è sparsa ed è arrivato fino al Vaticano.
Word got around and even got to the Vatican, which summoned me and commissioned me to paint the portrait of Pope John Paul II. The result was judged to be excellent, and the painting became the official portrait of the Pope. Later, I carried out another 4 portraits of Pope Wojtyła. One is in Washington at the John Paul II Cultural Center. Another was donated by Cardinal Stanislaw Dziewicz to the Basilica of Santa Maria del Popolo here in Rome. And the other 2 are on display in Detroit, Michigan. Then I was commissioned to do the official portrait of Pope John Paul I, and then the one of Pope Benedict XVI.
Giovanni Paolo I, e quindi quello di Papa Benedetto XVI.
Natalia Tsarkova has since become the official portrait artist of the popes and of many Vatican officials. She's the first woman ever to have the job.
Posso dire che è stato la realizzazione di un mio sogno.
I can say that this has been one of my dreams come true. I continue to thank the Lord for having given me this possibility. It's also a big responsibility and a great honor of which I am proud.
Quale vado fiera.
Natalia, you also met Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict. Tell me about your meetings with them and what did they have to say to you?
Io ho avuto questo onore di avere audienza privata.
Yes, I had the honor of meeting them in private audience. This was a very moving and beautiful experience for me. Something very special happened when I presented my first official portrait of Pope John Paul II to him.
Lui mi ha detto in russo. Ha detto in russo, sì, che sono stata molto sorpresa.
He told me in Russian. Yes, Russian. I was very surprised at that. I didn't know the Holy Father spoke Russian well, but he said this to me. You're Russian. Long live Russian art. Continue as you're doing. And so I have been continuing, as he said, up to this day. More than 15 years have already gone by, and I have painted the portrait now of my 3rd Pope. I'm very happy.
Using brushstrokes similar to Velázquez, Natalia possesses an uncanny ability to enter into her subject's very soul. From a moistened eye to a furrowed brow to a tentative smile, Natalia unveils the very intimate side of her subjects. It's like we're standing in the very same room.
Much like Leonardo da Vinci in his forays into portraiture, played a complex game of drawing out the psychology, the personality, the inner depths of the sitter, and always making us aware of the tension that the sitter tries to disguise certain aspects of his or her person. Natalia removes that tension, that barrier, and opens up to us a facet of her sitter that's a little bit unexpected. So in a figure that we see as very formal or very business oriented, we see an interest in culture. In an iconic figure, we get something homey and comfortable. And so she throws in these wonderful little facets that her observations give us about a sitter.
But how can she paint the portrait of someone like Pope John Paul I, John Paul II's predecessor, so long after he had died and still make him so alive? I wondered. I discovered that like everything she does, Natalia doesn't leave much up to chance, just to divine providence, which she says often guides her brush. To prepare for her job, she studies the writings, photographs, and videos of her subjects, investigates their lives, their hobbies, passions, and their favorite things. As she painted John Paul I, Natalia filled her studio with the sound of the Pope's voice, as he read a homily or pronounced a special discourse. She submerges herself in the personality of the person she's painting, and the results are, oh, so tangible.
Art historian Kenneth Clark, a long time ago, tried to describe for us in a very small book what is a masterpiece. And he encapsulated a masterpiece in few words, something that draws together the past, the great historical tradition, but again, takes that tradition and projects it into the future. And that is what Natalia Tsarkova does. And that is the way the church has always commissioned art, taken artists who have a sense of the long tradition of the church, because the church is about tradition. And so the idea of an artist who understands that he or she is part of a long line of contributors to the culture of the church, but then that individual genius of that individual moment in time helps to project the images towards the future. So Natalia very much represents exactly what the church has always done in commissioning church art, and is a very good model for our day of how to continue to commission church art.
Though she studied her subject for more than a year before she put paint to canvas, it only took Natalia 3 months to paint her portrait of Benedict XVI. In the composition, Natalia has placed the Holy Father sitting on an ornately carved wooden chair, an antique throne, she calls it, full of symbolism, an inherent aspect of all her works.
Il Santo Padre è rimasto molto contento.
The Holy Father was very pleased. There are symbolic objects in it, and the Holy Father really appreciated these. Symbolism is fundamental in this painting. The color, the positioning, the background, everything is important because it points to a deeper meaning and message. For example, in the painting of Pope Benedict XVI, the Holy Father is sitting on a throne, and this throne really exists. It's the throne of Pope Leo XIII, and it's full of rich symbolism, carved angels and the dove symbolizing the Holy Spirit. When I saw this throne, I knew absolutely that the Holy Father had to sit on this throne. Later, I discovered the Holy Father loves this throne very much. So for me, this holds very special meaning.
Invece nel quadro, lo Spirito Santo illumina il Papa.
In the painting, the Holy Spirit shines down on the Pope. Its light illuminates the Holy Father and the angels come to life. One angel, whose eyes are alive, looks in the direction of the Pope. The Pope draws back his mantle with one hand and reveals the other angel, who takes on new life, looking towards us, engaging those of us in this world. The Holy Father is dressed in red robes, red, the symbol of love and faith. He's also holding a manuscript of his discourses and homilies, also very symbolic. It's a symbol of peace, because it's only through dialogue that peace can truly be achieved.
Natalia is convinced divine providence whispers in her ear. That's why she chose the throne of Leo XIII, embellished as it is with angels.
The painting was already finished, but it had yet to be presented to the Holy Father. During one of his homilies at the time, the Holy Father said, "Every bishop is an angel of the church." It was beautiful, a real intuition. I was happy to hear him say this, because it really confirmed what I had hoped to achieve in the painting.
Symbolism is equally important in her portraits of John Paul II, like this one, depicting an aged Holy Father standing curved slightly over his pastoral staff.
In this painting, too, the pose of the Holy Father is important. He's leaning his weight on his pastoral staff, as if he's carrying the weight of the world's suffering. He's bearing this weight with the strength of love, thanks to his staff. Reflected in the staff is the image of Our Lady with the child Jesus, because the Madonna always leads the Holy Father. I've put her close to his heart, because it was she who saved the life of the Holy Father. This was the third secret of Fatima, but I painted this before the third secret was revealed to the world.
svelato.
In October 2001, the world's bishops were gathered here in the Vatican to discuss the theme, the bishop, servant of the gospel of Jesus Christ for the hope of the world. It was the first synod of the new millennium and the first synod ever to be painted by an artist.
It was the first synod of the third millennium, just after the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001. So this was a very significant synod. It was a real honor for me when they invited me to immortalize this very significant event.
Natalia spent 1 month with the bishops, painting them as they participated in the working sessions. During breaks, they'd pause to chat with her and check her progress. Pope John Paul would open and close each day with a prayer.
I put each person in the actual chair he was sitting in. These aren't miniature portraits, they're mini miniature portraits. The composition is like a mountaintop looking down towards the Pope, who is the center of light.
This light that illumines Natalia's paintings emanates not just from the popes, the angels, or the Holy Spirit in her compositions. It's a light that sparkles in Natalia's eyes when she speaks of her work and of her greatest dream.
I'd like to paint my own Sistine Chapel. I say the Sistine Chapel in a symbolic way. For me, it represents the epitome, the summit of all great art. I don't know if I'll ever have the chance to do a project like this, but I hope in divine providence that the Lord will grant me this possibility, because I would like so much to do something truly important.
Great art is a two-way street. Yes, you need a talented artist who is who's able to envision great stories. You also need some pretty enlightened patronage. And the artists with the greatest potential that we have in the 21st century spend most of their time doing portraits, because most people commission images of themselves. But when you have a mind like Natalia Tsarkova or several of the other present-day artists who are capable of thinking out ideas like Natalia's giant Last Supper painting, giving these artists the possibility of working on a large-scale project of a great story, a part of man's salvation or the revelation of God, that's something for them to sink their teeth in. That calls out an excellence which goes far beyond, the sitter of an individual person. And so I would like very much to see this concert between the artist and the patron offer the artist the possibility to show what he or she actually has by taking on the greatest subject matters possible.
Is Natalia Tsarkova another Michelangelo just begging to release a torrent of fabulously fresh ideas and an unparalleled mastery of the brush? Can she challenge the 21st century's godless man to appreciate God's great plan for all mankind? I don't know, but she sure is off to one heck of a start.
Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.